And that is to say, it's not just the racist rhetoric. The racist rhetoric and the culture wars and the hatred toward women, the hatred toward immigrants, the hatred toward the trans community is a form of deflection. And then the president run the record and show how this same person who's spewing all of this division, guess what? He's not addressing the issue of poverty in your state. He's not addressing more than 40% of the people working for less than a living wage, even though the people voted for a living wage to happen in Florida. He's not addressing the more than 2.5 million people that don't have health care. In other words, connect the rhetoric not just to the deaths that are caused by someone like the young man who did what he did and creating the ethos of death, but actually show how they are failing in their roles as governors and legislators. And that's why they want the division and the deflection and deception, so that we don't see how they're also engaging in forms of policy violence and policy murder, which is hurting the lives of people. And it doesn't have to be that way. Imagine if the same governor was bringing people together, was raising the minimum wage, was ensuring health care, and those things, Florida would be a very, very different place. He does not want people to look at that, and so he's posturing himself like the Dixiecrat governors of the old South, and we need a new South to rise that's not fooled by that, that brings black people together, white people together, brown people, Asian, Latinos, gay, straight, it doesn't matter who you are, and says we're not having it anymore, we're taking back the mic, we're mobilizing, and we're going to do it. Because the fact of the matter is, Ron, if just 2-3% of poor and low wealth voters in Florida who have not voted chose to vote an agenda, they could send any candidate home, including Ron DeSantis. Poor and low wealth folk have the power. That's what Bishop Frank Reed and others are saying. They understand, and why they're calling for this is that there comes a time, the Bible says, when the stone that the builders rejected have to rise up and become the cornerstone of a new reality. That's what we're going to launch on Thursday and beyond. It must happen not just in Florida, but across the country. Take back this mic.
And Bishop Barber, I wanted to ask you, Ron DeSantis is still only he's not the major candidate for the Republican Party. Obviously, Donald Trump still remains the major candidate. And could you comment on Trump's virtual silence on all of these racist attacks that have been occurring, these hate crimes around the country?
Well, you know, he laid the foundation for it, so he doesn't have to say anything. His very presence has already laid it down. He does enough at his rally. I mean, he's the provocateur par excellence. You know, he's the one that has really laid the playbook down, and Ron DeSantis is playing it. But I think Ron DeSantis in some ways is more dangerous than Trump because of his background, his education, that he's been a governor. Trump had never held political office, and that Ron DeSantis is doing all these things as a governor. Right now, he's caught up, you know, in the popularity of Trump among people who are mean and racist. You know, he doesn't have that kind of play nationally, but he has that kind of play within the party. And he has a lot of play within the country because of the ongoing history of racism and division. And you know, hatred and meanness sells and works, and othering people turns a lot of people on. That's why folk that don't agree with it, we can't stay home. We can't have low voter turnout because that allows extremists to get elected. But DeSantis, I think, in some ways, and these legislators are more dangerous than Trump because they actually can enact policy. You see, they are actually passing policy. And that's what I don't want people to miss. I said to some people, it's okay for us to get upset when he attacks black history. It's right for us to be bothered with and move when these folk have been killed. But let's not just think that there wasn't a big problem before this. And there weren't problems beyond just the rhetoric. Go back to the policy. DeSantis is a failed governor. He's a man that only got elected the first time by 1.5% of the vote. He didn't get elected overwhelmingly. And then the second time, I think maybe about 3 or 4%. He's not even invincible. But as long as he has the mic, as long as he has that legislature, they can continue to push and promote not only rhetoric, but policy. And both the rhetoric and the policy is deadly. That's what makes DeSantis and these other extremists in these state houses and legislatures even more formidable in some way than Trump, because they actually have legislated. Now, right now, as they say, Trump right now has, you know, this popularity within the body of extremism. But make no mistake, these guys are not just running for office for right now. They're running, they're hoping Trump goes to jail. They're hoping they can step in afterwards. And if you listen to the Republicans that are running, there's not a dime of difference. There's not a penny of difference between them and the policies of Trump. The only thing they're differing is the antics of Trump in terms of the way he has done some things seemingly illegal. But they have the same policy, the same rhetoric, the same division, the same deception, the same denial of dealing with policy. It's the same thing.
Well, speaking of taking the mic, Bishop Barber, when after that young white male shooter killed three people, black people in Jacksonville, there was this vigil, and Governor Ron DeSantis took the mic. But he was booed roundly by the crowds. One attendee shouted out, "Your policies caused this." I want to play that clip.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is here. I'm going to ask the governor if he will come down and turn the mic.
Was going on at that vigil. So there you have just the crowd essentially taking the mic. But then you have in Tennessee, a young man you know well just celebrated his 28th birthday, the legislator, Justin Jones, who was thrown out along with another Justin Pearson, one represents Nashville, the other Memphis, of the state legislature.
Yeah, Justin Jones was silenced.
And now, then he was thrown out. They spent a lot of money having to redo the election. He's voted right back in by Nashville. And then last week, he is silenced by the legislature. This is the last minute we have. But if you can talk about what's happening.
Well, a couple of things. Justin Jones got elected in the most diverse district in Tennessee. Let's note that. That's why he's such a thing of fear to the extremists. Also, he got silenced when he went to the floor to put a slate of policies, 12 things that he's calling on legislators to join him in fighting for. He's not just dealing in the emotionalism. He's actually dealing in policy. DeSantis was booed, should have been booed, because the only reason he should have been there was to get on his knees and repent for how he has helped create an atmosphere and an ethos of othering that and division that gives license to this kind of violence. We've seen it down through history. But I also want to say to Floridian, even before this happened, he should have been booed. He should have been booed for the way that he has not dealt with poverty. He should have been booed for the way he's not dealt with living wages. He should have been booed for the way he's blocked health care. He should have been booed for the way he lied and caused people to die, in essence, by saying you don't need to get vaccine. He has a whole record that needs to be booed, and that's what I'm arguing for. He need not just for when he has attacked Black history, and in this moment, sure, this is what we see here, and all that rhetoric has created such a bad atmosphere. But look at his whole record, and let's take the mic and raise up and mobilize all over the country, starting in Florida, people who will not be about partisan politics, but will be about principle politics, and say, if you are going to use the mic to spread division, deception, and distraction, and create an ethos of death and violence, we're going to take the mic from you, send you home the best way we can, in love and through our votes. Our votes are going to speak. Our voices are going to speak. Because what we cannot have in this moment is leaders who use powerful position to create a kind of a pathological atmosphere and an ethos of violence and destruction. Well, it's been deadly in the past and it's deadly in the present.
Bishop William Barber, we thank you for being with us. Present Senior Lecturer, Repairers of the Breach, Founding Director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. We'll link to your new piece in The Guardian, "The Racist Murders in Jacksonville Didn't Happen in a Vacuum. Words Came First." Coming up, we speak with a psychologist, Roy Idelson, whose new book is just out, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. Back in 30 seconds. 4KVHS, Mandy, Indiana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A military judge at Guantanamo has thrown out the confessions of a Saudi man because he'd been subjected to waterboarding and other forms of torture at secret CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Thailand, Poland, Romania, and Morocco. Abdulrahim al-Nashiri was detained in 2002 and held for 4 years at the black sites. Then in 2006, he was transferred to Guantanamo, where he's been held ever since. He's alleged to have been the mastermind behind the bombing of the USS Cole. In 2007, he confessed to his role in the bombing, but a military judge, Colonel Lanny Acosta Jr., recently tossed that confession, writing, quote, "Any resistance the accused might have been inclined to put up when asked to incriminate himself was intentionally and literally beaten out of him years before." Acosta went on to write, "Even if the 2007 statements were not obtained by torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, they were derived from it," unquote. During a hearing last year, the psychologist James Mitchell admitted he and another psychologist, Bruce Jessen, had waterboarded al-Nashiri at a CIA black site. Al-Nashiri was also subject to mock executions, isolation, sleep deprivation, and confinement inside a tiny wooden box. In June, the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention called for al-Nashiri's immediate release. The two psychologists involved in his torture, Mitchell and Jessen, have been paid at least $81 million by the CIA to develop and implement the CIA's post-9/11 torture program. According to the ACLU, torture methods devised by Mitchell and Jessen included slamming detained men into walls, stuffing them inside coffin-like boxes, exposing them to extreme temperatures and ear-splitting levels of music, starving them, inflicting various kinds of water torture, depriving them of sleep for days, and chaining them in stress positions designed for pain and to keep them awake for days on end. The actions of Drs. Mitchell and Jessen led to other psychologists raising concerns about them with the American Psychological Association, the APA. But the concerns were dismissed by the organization's leadership, eager to please the administration of President George W. Bush. Anti-torture psychologists led a multi-year campaign challenging the collusion of the APA, the world's largest professional association of psychologists, about 150,000 of them, with the Pentagon and the CIA. The APA leadership was ultimately ousted, and the APA barred its members from participating in harsh interrogations. Well, we're joined now by the psychologist Roy Idelson. He's the author of the new book, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror, that's just out today. He's a member of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology and past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. We welcome you, Dr. Idelson, to Democracy Now! I was wondering
Thanks very much, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. I'm wondering if you can start off by talking about how that legacy of the APA, I mean, they ousted their leadership, you see it continuing today.
Sure. The APA definitely got off on a very bad foot right after the attacks of September 11th, and it took efforts by a community of dissident psychologists. It took over a decade for us to bring change in terms of APA's policy toward interrogation and detention operations, whether it's at CIA black sites or at Guantanamo. For a long time, the APA said that psychologists helped to keep these operations safe, legal, ethical, and effective. And none of that was true. Finally, in 2015, the APA, after Jim Risen's book revealed information, after a internal report authorized by the APA board revealed how the APA leadership had collaborated covertly with the military intelligence establishment, the APA made some important reforms in the ethics arena. One of them is that psychologists cannot participate in national security interrogations. Another is that psychologists cannot be present at unlawful sites like Guantanamo unless they're working directly for the detainees or they're taking care of the military personnel, their health care. So it was a huge deal in 2015, this change, and APA leadership almost unanimously supported it. The problem is, or a problem, since then, things are step by step seeming to slip back, and there are powerful factions within the APA and outside of it, primarily military psychologists and the Department of Defense, that want to turn back the clock. And they, in fact, want to expand the opportunities that are available for psychologists to work in this arena where do no harm is at best secondary and sometimes off the table entirely.
And Dr. Idelson, could you talk about how you and other dissenters, the battle that you had, the reaction of your colleagues, and how you were able to get the association finally to take a stand?
Sure. It took years of dedicated effort by many people who became known as the dissident psychologists because we were opposed to APA's policies in support of the Pentagon. Throughout that process, as we developed materials, as we pushed the APA to change what it was doing, we were constantly confronted by it was either stonewalling, they would ignore us, or they would make attempts to discredit us, or there were things that essentially amounted to threats against some of our members, such as an ethics complaint filed against one member of the coalition, a defamation lawsuit filed against another coalition member. And in their public statements, they did not like us, let's put it that way. One APA president referred to us as opportunistic commentators masquerading as scholars. A military psychologist in his self-congratulatory memoir referred to us as clowns who have never seen the whites of a terrorist's side eyes. And another APA president, in her presidential column, seemingly compared us to the Dementors. And if you're familiar with Harry Potter or the world of Harry Potter, Dementors are cloaked figures who feed on human happiness. So this was the position, the response we got repeatedly. It didn't stop us because we felt there was a lot at stake. And we lost many battles that I describe. But eventually, in part thanks to broader awareness, public awareness of what actually had unfolded, APA was kind of pushed to make a decision, are we going to continue to pretend that we're on the right side of this, or are we going to institute reforms? And fortunately, they picked the latter.
I wanted to follow up on our previous segment where we were talking about Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor. Well, prior to entering politics, the presidential hopeful and Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, served in the Navy as an attorney at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo, also served in Fallujah, Iraq. DeSantis's time at Guantanamo is coming under scrutiny after a former prisoner named Mansour Daifi said that DeSantis had personally witnessed him being force-fed and tortured. Other prisoners have backed up Daifi's account. DeSantis has denied authorizing force feeding at Guantanamo. This is a clip.
The Washington Post did a big deep dive on this today, actually, about what you did out there. One of the things they said was that you authorized the use of force feeding.
That's not true. Yeah. Any of the stuff that people...
Just to finish, force feeding the detainees who were on hunger strike. Was that true?
So I was a junior officer. I didn't have authority to authorize anything. There may have been a commander that would have done feeding if someone was going to die, but that was not something that I would have even had authority to do.
So that's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was Ron DeSantis in an interview with Piers Morgan. But in an interview in 2018, he admitted to CBS Miami that he'd authorized force feeding.
I was a legal advisor.
For those that were doing
the things that would happen is the thing you notice the day you get down there is for these detainees, the jihad was still ongoing. Right. And they would wage jihad any way they can. Now, they're in a facility, so it's limited. But some of the things they would do hunger strikes. And you actually had three detainees that committed suicide with hunger strikes. So everything at that time was legal in nature one way or another. So the commander wants to know, well, how do I combat this? So one of the jobs of the legal advisor would be like, hey, you actually can force feed. Here's what you can do. Here's kind of the rules of that.
So if you could respond to this, Roy Idelson, what DeSantis's dissent, what his response is and how you have shown what is going on at Guantanamo.
Sure. Basically, he in some of those interviews, he acknowledged what he did. He did not have a from what I understand, a high-level position at Guantanamo, but he had a position of some legal expertise, and he recommended that one way to deal with the hunger strikes was to force feed. But not only did force feeding take place, the most brutal form of force feeding that's seemingly possible was used by the Department of Defense. There was no reason to do it that way, even if there was a decision to do it, which many international experts would say was unlawful. But DeSantis is just, I think, an example of a much broader concern, which is the number of politicians who have no concern for the detainees who were ever at Guantanamo or who are still there now. There was a narrative built from the very beginning by the Bush administration that the people we have captured are the worst of the worst and that torture is working, is an effective means to obtain information, and that using enhanced interrogation techniques has saved many American lives. None of that is true. They were not the worst of the worst. Most of the almost 800 detainees who were taken to Guantanamo were swept up off of battlefields in Afghanistan or in exchange for bounty payments from the U.S. government. They had no connection to al-Qaeda, no connection to international terrorism. They spent years, in some cases decades, at Guantanamo anyway. And the message that the American people have gotten most often is that we needed to do this. We did the right thing. These were very, very bad people. These were people who would, you know, one general said, who would gnaw through the hydraulic lines in a C-17 to bring it down. And so DeSantis, what's most disturbing, I think, is that he has achieved the position he has, that he's seemingly a serious contender to be president of the United States. And so in that way, he's a bigger deal than many other politicians, but there are many in the Senate and the House. And of course, we shouldn't forget that the president before this one also had a very positive view of Guantanamo, a very negative view of the detainees that had been placed there, and was eager to add more people to Guantanamo.
And Dr. Idelson, the American Psychological Association recently approved operational guidelines for its members. Your assessment of those guidelines, especially in view of the fact that they were written by, put together by military psychologists rather than ethicists or those harmed by past practices?
Yeah, this is a very recent new concern, and that is that operational psychologists who are not clinicians, they're focused on issues of national security and national defense, they are eager to expand the opportunities for them to do work that doesn't involve avoiding harm, that doesn't involve informed consent, that doesn't involve oversight by outside ethical boards. And what they've managed to do, regrettably, is persuade the APA governing council to approve a new set of practice guidelines. And these guidelines, basically now they have this the initial stamp of approval that APA is in favor of operational psychologists engaging in these kinds of activities. What's three things, I guess, are especially noteworthy about those guidelines. One, as you noted, they were written by military psychologists, many of them, several of them, defense contractors. And no one on that task force was an ethicist, or there was no representation for the people who have been tragically harmed by the abuse and torture that psychologists have produced in terms of the treatment of detainees. The other two things are, one, those guidelines make no mention of this awful history of psychology and psychologists during the war on terror. It seems really peculiar for someone interested in practicing operational psychology to read a set of guidelines and not even be told about what has happened, about the history, the troubling history. And the other one is there's no mention of APA's current policies. So there are policies, as I mentioned, that restrict involvement in interrogations and that restrict involvement at Guantanamo and similar places. There's no mention of this in these guidelines at all. So it's really troubling. It's a sign, as I tried to suggest, that it feels as though APA is slipping back into positions that led to awful things. We haven't given up.
You know, Dr. Idelson, Democracy Now! Has covered this debate within the APA extensively over the years. In 2005, we went out to the APA conference in San Francisco. I mean, you had psychologists putting bags over their heads and looking like the photographs we saw at Abu Ghraib, protesting what was going on. I was really struck by the number of uniformed psychologists, as you said, military psychologists there were within the association that were really direct the discussion. But we only have a minute, and I wanted to ask you about that top lead going into you about the military judge at Guantanamo who's just thrown out the confessions of the Saudi man because he'd been subjected to torture, waterboarding, and other forms of torture at CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Thailand, Poland, Romania, Morocco. I'm talking about Abdelrahim al-Nashiri, who was detained over 20 years ago, held for 4 years at these black sites, then in 2006 transferred to Guantanamo, where he's been held ever since. Your response to the judge throwing out what he has said because of torture. We just have 30 seconds.
It's, in my view, it's an excellent decision. It's the right decision. We'll see whether it's appealed and what comes of that. I think it's important, though, to emphasize that Mr. al-Nashiri was far from the only detainee who was treated brutally, who was abused, who was tortured, not just at CIA black sites, but at Guantanamo as well. So many of them have awful stories to tell if we're willing to listen. This was a massive problem, and Mr. al-Nashiri is a really important example of what happens when we fail to uphold the principles our country is supposed to live
by. Roy Idelson, we want to thank you so much for being with us. His new book out today, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women in our lives. And we're looking to men like you, the men who make up our communities, to join us. You can play an active part to end violence. Visit www.whiteribbon.ca.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.